You may be seated. Thank you. The next case set for argument is State of South Dakota versus Maxim Pfeiffer. It's appeal number 30120. Connor Duffy is present. Will be arguing on behalf of the defendant appellant. Mr. Pfeiffer and Aaron Hanke is present and will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. So with that, Mr. Duffy, you can proceed with your initial 15-minute argument.
May it please the court, justices, counsel. First-degree manslaughter has an intent element. First-degree manslaughter, although not in the statute, I believe at this point it's undisputed that first-degree manslaughter requires at least that the act be done intentionally or recklessly. That much is clear black-letter law from State v. Mulligan. Mens rea, a particular state of mind, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt by the prosecution in order to convict someone of this subsection of first-degree manslaughter. And while I was going through the transcripts of the colloquy when they settled jury instructions, something that trial counsel, who was not me, mentioned during that colloquy stuck out to me. And he said, "What is the harm in telling the jury that?" And I would submit that question to the court. What is the harm in telling the jury that? It's an element of the crime. It's required. We know that by case law, that the state is required to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So what possible harm could have resulted from adding an intent element to jury instruction number 16?
I don't know that we could decide the case that way. The standard is more deferential than that. The cases say, as you know, that the arrangement of the instructions, the wording of the instructions, is largely within the discretion of the court. And also a review focuses on the instructions as a whole. So I think it's a good question. I understand what you mean by it, and I don't want to pick a nit, but I don't know that we can make the decision based upon whether it would have been better in another instruction. Our cases seem to suggest we could not do that.
Well, I think that we haven't had in South Dakota history a first-degree manslaughter case where we've isolated the intent element off in a different instruction as we have here.
How do you know that? What on what basis do you say that?
I just have not seen a published opinion where this is discussed, where we have the intent element being isolated off in its own instruction and the jury not instructed that the state has the burden of proof to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, that's you know, and not that the patterns are the only way that a case can be instructed by any means, but that's how it's laid out in our pattern instructions. So that just, it seemed like a strong statement that you just made, that we never have that. You're just referring to it not being discussed in a reported case?
Yes.
So let me ask you about instruction 19. I'm just going to read part of it. Crime of manslaughter, first degree, defendant must have criminal intent. When a person intentionally or recklessly does an act that the law declares to be a crime, the person is acting with criminal intent, even though the person may not know that the conduct is unlawful. What's missing in that instruction in terms of telling the jury that intent is a necessary element and required to prove first-degree manslaughter in this case?
I think that what is missing is what trial counsel proposed in this case, that from instruction 19, that if the state has failed to prove intent or recklessness beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant must be found not guilty.
But the court has an instruction about that too. The court gives the instruction saying if you find that the state has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt any of the elements of the offense, that you have to find him not guilty.
Agreed. And I think that by failing to put the intent element in instruction number 16 as a fourth element, that it misled and confused the jury into believing that intent or recklessness was not an element that the state had to prove here.
So there's another instruction. Instruction 33 said, if you have any reasonable doubt upon any single fact or element necessary to constitute the offense charged, then it's your duty to vote not guilty. So it's not just limited to an element, any fact or element necessary. So wouldn't that then loop in or refer to the necessary mens rea?
It may, but in a convoluted and altogether confusing way that was too confusing for this jury to understand is what I would submit. I think that the danger of doing it the way the trial court did it, of not adding the intent element to instruction number 16, that it played out exactly as Mr. Hanna, original trial counsel, predicted, that he said while settling jury instructions, he said, there's a real danger of the jury being misled or confused if you do not instruct them at this phase in the instructions that the state has the burden of proving intent.
He made that exact argument without objection during oral argument. So I sure understand your argument, and that is the issue in front of us. It did not, however, prevent him from making that precise argument. And again, without any objection or without any quarrel.
To the jury.
To the jury, that is.
Yes, that's true. I think that the instruction that closing arguments are not evidence, I think the jury takes that into heart. I think they take that to account, and that they really look at the instructions, and that the instruction that they got tripped up on here was number 16.
Within the range of choices. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, within the range of just choices for abuse of discretion, we would ultimately look and see from the record as a whole, not just confined to evidence, but from the record as a whole, hey, is there something here that suggests to us this was important enough to really make a difference and turn it? So, I mean, that would be something we would look at. Did this prevent this prevent the defense from making the exact argument that they wanted to make? And I'm just my observation is that it did not. So
I want to turn you to the mistake of fact instruction.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, why did the court refuse to give it, and why was it error?
I don't know exactly why the court refused to give it. I understand the argument that the Attorney General is making today, but the court's reasoning in refusing to give it was simply incorrect. Defense counsel said during the settling of instructions, he said, the prosecution must prove he either intentionally or recklessly fired the shot, which is clear black letter law from Mulligan. And the trial judge's response to that was, nope. No, you don't. That's a misstatement of the law. And so that's what the trial judge relied upon in denying the mistake of fact instruction. And that was totally incorrect.
The court gave that instruction. So I don't know that that's, accurate. Your quote, if you read the whole rest of that quote, then at the end, the court seems to acknowledge that there may be certain cases, certain general intent cases, where the instruction might be appropriate, but this isn't one of them. And I didn't really elaborate on that. So why, in your view, is this a case where even when you give the mens rea instruction that was given here, why was it then an error to not also give the mistake of fact instruction?
The denial of the mistake of fact instruction, by the time they got to the end of trial, the mistake of fact wasn't just the heart of their case. It was the entire case. And as the defense counsel said at trial, he said, if you don't give this instruction, you have gutted our defense.
But the mistake of fact was the mistake about whether the gun was loaded or not, right?
Correct.
So the mistake of fact, how would the mistake of fact preclude a finding of recklessness?
That's a good question. And I think that is a question for the jury. That is pointing a gun you subjectively and reasonably believe to be unloaded at another person and pulling the trigger, is that reckless? And I would submit to this court that the court's ruling and the Attorney General's argument on this topic that it must disprove intent or they use utterly disproves. I would submit to the court that this trial court determined as a matter of law that pointing a gun at someone and pulling the trigger is reckless, or at least that's what the Attorney General's position is. I think that should be a question for the jury, for the finder of fact, whether or not that is a reckless act. And that
how is it not a question before the jury? I mean, again, it's kind of like the other instruction issue. All of these very same arguments that you're making here were made to the jury by trial counsel based on the instructions that were given.
I think that a reasonable jury could determine that pointing a gun at someone that you believe to be unloaded and pulling the trigger does not rise to the level of recklessness. Perhaps it's negligent. That wouldn't get the job done here. That wouldn't get a conviction. Perhaps it's careless. That wouldn't rise to the level. I think they needed to be explicitly instructed on recklessness and told that if they don't find recklessness, that the defendant must be found not guilty. And that a mistake of fact instruction would have definitely assisted them in doing so.
It didn't seem like there was any real controversy about what he believed. And this kind of gets into your judicial admission or your judicial notice of the prosecutor's statement during the bond hearing argument as well. Maybe I'm not right on this, but it doesn't seem like the state really seriously disputed the idea or the notion that Mr. Pfeiffer believed it was unloaded.
I think you're correct on that as well. And that's why, as to issue number three, I didn't write that issue. And I do think that if you were to say this is not cumulative, that piece of evidence needed to come in. That's why I'm not here arguing that today, is because...
And I don't want to take your time with it, but it just kind of reminded me of it, because that is the mistake of fact that seems to permeate the mistake of fact issue, right? The mistake of fact is I thought it was unloaded.
Yeah, and I think overwhelming evidence was presented at trial, and I think that actually assists me in my argument.
So, back to your argument, the mistake of fact was necessary for your two, as you argued your theory of defense. So you had cited the State v. Charles opinion to support that notion about when a defendant is entitled to an instruction on a theory of defense. But that case was very similar to this one, where a defendant who's actually charged with first-degree murder, a specific intent crime, had a claim that he believed that the rifle at issue was unloaded. And this court, in considering the same argument here, found that the denial of a mistake fact instruction was not an abuse of discretion or an error if there was a proper mens rea instruction given. So I'm just wondering how do you distinguish this case to such that this court could then find an abuse of discretion here when you compare it to what was before the court in State v. Charles?
Well, I think you just told me, which is a proper mens rea instruction, and why these two issues are intertwined, is that this wasn't a proper mens rea instruction. I don't find that instruction number 19 as to recklessness was an appropriate or proper instruction as to the intent in this case. And so
because of the burden of proof, what was improper about that instruction?
What's that?
What was improper about that instruction?
That the burden of proof instruction was too isolated from number 16 or number 19 for the jury to really take that in and say, okay, if they haven't proved recklessness here, then the defendant is not guilty. And I think it was just these instructions as a whole were isolated, and that burden of proof was lost in the shuffle. And I think that their question, now the jury came back with five questions, and they were under seal. I didn't find them until after I had written the reply brief. But the jurors' question during deliberation, they asked five of them. This one is the most pertinent, I think. They asked, does a person assume the inherent responsibility of injury caused by picking up a deadly weapon? Is a person legally responsible for a weapon once it is picked up? And I think this question is indicative of a misled and confused jury, that they think this is a strict liability crime. They think that firearm plus death automatically equals first-degree manslaughter as a matter of law, no matter what happened. And I think this question is telling as to what was going through their mind and is evidence that they were improperly instructed. And that the way to avoid that was to do what trial counsel proposed, primarily put recklessness as an intent element in instruction number 16. That would have primarily, and give a mistake of fact instruction. without...
Let me just clarify. You indicated number three is probably not an issue. You're really asserting it at this point. Sufficiency of the evidence, is that an issue that is still in play here?
Well, and I don't want to say that I'm not abandoning or forfeiting issue number three. I just see that it may undermine my two stronger issues. That was, you know, obviously not a brief that I wrote. The sufficiency of the evidence, yes, we're still making that argument as well, that there was not sufficient evidence to show recklessness here, given the inadequate instruction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Ms. Anke, may you proceed with your argument?
May it please the court, counsel. This case does not hinge on what defendant was thinking when he picked up a loaded firearm, pointed it at his friend, and pulled the trigger. It is about whether or not he acted recklessly when he did so. Manslaughter is a general intent crime, but defense is trying to bootstrap it into a specific intent crime. His belief of the gun being unloaded does not negate his reckless behavior. At the beginning of his argument, Mr. Duffy makes the comment, or asks this court the question, what would be the harm in instructing the jury on intent in the elements instruction number 16? But that's not the question before this court. The question before this court is if the circuit court abused its discretion when formulating the jury instructions. And we look at it, did the court properly instruct the jury? Did they properly tell the correct law? And here they did. The jury was properly instructed as to what the law was, and there was no abuse of discretion. There was some discussion about whether or not intent has ever been given or not given in an elements instruction, and it hasn't, at least not in manslaughter. I should clarify. In manslaughter, it's not typically given. The circuit court was very conscientious when it was settling jury instructions, and it relied a lot on the State v. Birdshead case. And in fact, when deciding the not only elements instruction, but also instruction number 19, the criminal intent, the circuit court looked to Birdshead and followed it almost to the T. And this court upheld the Birdshead instructions for intent, so why wouldn't it uphold the instruction here? There's been nothing
when you, when you make a statement like it's not typically given, what is that based on? Besides, now you're citing me one case. I mean, how do we know what is typically given?
Certainly looking at criminal pattern and jury instructions, in general intent crimes, it's typically the actus reus elements are considered the elements of the crime, and intent is given in a separate instruction.
Of course, and then the exception of that would be is if you have a crime that by statute includes a mens rea in the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Specific intent, for example.
Yes, that is correct. Okay. For first-degree manslaughter, it's a general intent crime. And when we look at other first-degree manslaughter cases that this court has ruled on, Mulligan, for instance, and Birdshead, they have been separated out.
And I agree that with your characterization of what the question is before this court, but just so that there's no confusion, there isn't anything that would preclude a court from including the mens rea instruction in one instruction that included the statutory element.
There's nothing to suggest that, Your Honor. Like I said, the court just has to make sure they're properly instructing the jury.
So what was the court's reason for not including this instruction?
I believe it found it wasn't necessary. It wasn't a requirement for the court to include it or not include it. I don't remember its specific wording in declining to include it, Your Honor.
Your opposing counsel said the same thing. I don't really know why the judge didn't include it.
And I don't think it matters why it didn't include it, Your Honor, because looking at those instructions as a whole, the jury was correctly instructed. The court didn't give the jury a wrong instruction.
How do we assess the exercise of discretion if we don't know what discretion was, or how he exercised his discretion? You said it's abuse of discretion standard, correct?
Correct. And so with abuse of discretion, again, it followed what Birdshead did that this court affirmed. So you can't say the court abused its discretion when it was following the guidelines from this court. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
that's up to you to decide.
Okay.
Do you think manslaughter, circle back to your discussion with Justice Duhanna, do you think manslaughter is a little bit particular in some ways? In other words, the discussion where you said, hey, you know, the instruction, the elements instruction will include a mens rea requirement where the statute has it. This doesn't, but what it does is it suggests it's a killing without design. It suggests it's an unintentional killing. Is there some wisdom in saying, you know, hey, you should probably have the part that clarifies the mens rea right there? Because otherwise you're talking about an offense where someone has undertaken the conduct without any design that killed somebody, without any design to kill them, sort of suggesting it's unintentional. Would it make some sense to sort of say, yeah, you still have to have criminal intent? I know we have other instructions to do that, but this particular statute, if I'm hearing the argument from Mr. Duffy, kind of right, is particular in that respect. Because I'm not saying it negates a mens rea, but it's a particular type of mens rea or a particular type of requirement that it be without design.
Whether they're separated or not, Your Honor, they're still given to the jury.
I understand.
And instruction 19, the criminal intent instruction, does specifically state defendant must have criminal intent. And so they're not misleading as separate.
Your opposing counsel's argument seems to be something like this. It's not enough for the judge just to give the accurate recitation of the law. He also needs to put it in a way that that explains it to help the jury accomplish its goal. So he's saying that, and it refers back to Justice Salter's question there, you know, maybe reorienting it and placing it in a different position helps the jury more. I mean, we can't just dump a criminal law treatise on them and expect them to figure it out. These are difficult concepts. So why address the argument about placement that he made?
So when we add in criminal intent to these elements, the actus reus, if you will, it could create more confusion as to what exactly is going on. And additionally, when we look at this case and look at Judge, when the circuit court was determining these, again, the court was following the precedent set out before it. And so if this court were to decide that mens rea should be in a fourth element of the crime, it can't be held that the circuit court abused its discretion by not knowing that when it was following the precedent that this court has set.
You agree it wouldn't have been error if the judge had included that instruction?
I don't think it would have been error, Your Honor, but I also don't think it was error to not include them.
I want to ask you about the mistake of fact instruction.
Yes, Your Honor.
If it should have been given, in your view, is it reversible error? And if it's not reversible error, why not?
It's not reversible error, Your Honor. Defendant hasn't been able to show how he was prejudiced by not giving that instruction. He was very much still able to present the defense of he did not think that firearm was loaded when he picked it up, when he pointed it. So he wasn't precluded from presenting a defense at all. He wasn't prejudiced. And that instruction wasn't appropriate in this particular crime. For a mistake of fact and instruction to be given, the defendant's state of mind must be an element. In his, whether or not he thought this gun was loaded is not the element here that the state must prove. It's whether or not he acted recklessly. So his mindset doesn't matter.
Opposing counsel argues this confused the jury, and then he says, we don't have to doubt whether it confused the jury. You look at the questions sent out by the jury, and the jury is struggling with this very issue because of the questions that it asked. So why is that not the prejudice?
I don't think we can really invade the province of the jury and isolate one single question the jury had for the court and say they were confused, there's prejudice. There needs to be more than that, Your Honor. And when looking at the evidence was overwhelming that defendant did act recklessly when he did this conduct. He picked up a gun. He did not take the magazine out. He did not properly clear that gun. He pointed it at his friend, and he pulled the trigger. He admitted readily that he knew basic firearm safety. He had firearms. He shot firearms in the past. And he knew you never point a gun, loaded or unloaded, at somebody you don't plan on shooting, and you certainly don't pull the trigger. And so the evidence was overwhelming to his reckless behavior.
Just to clarify, you know, a record, and you had argued he picked up the gun, he didn't take the magazine out. There was a disputed fact on that. He claimed he did, but then we have a witness that found the gun that had a live round still. So
correct,
that's
Your
what
Honor.
You're referring to.
Yes, Your Honor, and just to note, especially when reviewing sufficiency of the evidence, we look at that most favorable to the verdict, which would support the state's theory of the case.
Ms. Yenge, Instruction 16 lists as a third element that the defendant did so or caused this death without any design to affect the death of the victim. And we talked about this a few moments ago. Is that really even an element? Or is it just something that the statute includes that distinguishes this from murder? In other words, the absence of a design to affect the death. Is that even really an element? Does the state have to prove that he didn't murder him? Or is it enough to say we're charging with manslaughter, not murder?
I mean, you certainly hit the nail on the head, Your Honor. If he did intend to cause the death, then we would be looking at a murder case. And so that is the distinguishing factor.
If it's not an element, I don't mean to speak in riddles, which I said earlier too. If it's not an element, does that strengthen Mr. Duffy's argument that we should have some indication in this instruction about what the jury is to determine was criminal about this offense and this conduct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that?
Yeah, sure. So let's say three really isn't an element in a true sense. It's the absence of conduct that would otherwise qualify this as a murder. So then that would leave us with the defendant caused the death of the victim, and the killing was, in this case, by means of a dangerous weapon. Stop.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't there be something else in that list of elements that requires the jury to look at that and say, yeah, this is what makes this criminal?
Are you suggesting, Your Honor?
Well, that's Mr. Duffy's argument,
okay,
that this element, you know, dealing with criminal intent should have been mm-hmm. included among the elements. And so I'm sort of saying that would provide a sort of a list of elements, one of which makes this conduct criminal, all in one instruction.
So substituting basically element three with the criminal intent.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to say it.
Okay. Maybe, Your Honor. But again, when we look at the history that this court has set out for us in the circuit court to look at, to me, how the circuit court instructed the jury wasn't outside the realm of possibilities for the circuit court to instruct.
Or outside the range of...
Or range of permissible. And so, again, if this court were to determine that's the better option to go or the better route to go, it cannot be said that the circuit court here abused its discretion when making its decision. It did. If there are no additional questions, the state respectfully requests this court to affirm defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Duffy, you can proceed with rebuttal.
So the assertion that in manslaughter cases, the actus reus and the mens rea are typically separated out, I don't think that's the case. If you look at the pattern jury instruction on heat of passion, first-degree manslaughter, heat of passion, which is clearly a mental state, it's clearly an intent element, is added in with the actus reus elements. So there are, even within the patterns, there are instructions to include those two things. I think that's kind of what got the trial court into trouble here was this kind of academic chin-stroking about this is actus reus, this is mens rea. They're just elements. They're things that the state has to prove, and I don't think that labeling them with Latin terms and saying that they're somehow different or they should somehow be separate is productive. And I think that's what happened here, that they should have just all been in one instruction, and that there are instances, even in the pattern jury instructions, where that would be done with heat of passion. As to Birdshead, as to this court affirming the instructions in Birdshead, that's different because Birdshead was specifically asking that recklessness not be in the instructions. It was a self-defense case, very different than an accidental killing case. He didn't want recklessness in the instructions. This court determined that recklessness was okay to be in the instruction. It's kind of an opposite case in that sense. And additionally, I don't think we should look at a certain case and the facts of that case and say, okay, this court approved the jury instructions in this case, so that means it's good for all manslaughter cases. The pattern jury instruction for first-degree manslaughter of these subsections is a mess. It's got all these parentheses in it. It's not a good pattern jury instruction. We shouldn't give it so much deference. I think that particularly when the facts in a case like this require, as Mr. Hanna made clear in his when they were settling jury instructions, that you should have some different jury instructions if they're requested. And I think in this case, particularly because it is so in opposite of what the facts of Birdshead and the reasoning in Birdshead, that we shouldn't let the fact that those instructions were given in Birdshead control here.
Going back to the prejudice requirement, and so if we were to conclude that the court abused its discretion and should have included the mens rea, the recklessness requirement within the elements instruction, how, you know, I've read the closing arguments a number of times. Both counsel spent a considerable amount of time talking about whether or not this was a reckless act. So how is it ultimately prejudicial then in terms of how the case was ultimately argued in before the jury?
I think it was prejudicial, and certainly there were some statements in the closing arguments, the main one being we don't have to show intent, which was an incorrect assertion of the law. And additionally, I think that recklessness, them not being specifically instructed, that if recklessness is not proven, that the verdict must be not guilty, and that didn't occur anywhere in the instructions. And I think that, I mean, there's an additional question. The third question they asked is there any other information you can give us in regards to number 19, specifically criminal intent, and number 23, specifically reckless, and or reckless with a respect to circumstances when a person consciously and unjustifiably disregards a substantial risk that such circumstance exists. I think that additionally, that question shows that they are confused by these concepts being placed into different instructions, isolated further away from that statement that if they haven't proved it beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant is not guilty.
Or is that, you know, in whether, you know, even if we were to consider, you know, and try to read between the lines of a jury's questions, it could that also be considered of the jury really struggling with how to apply the definition of reckless to the facts of this case, as opposed to a misunderstanding that it was not something that had to be proven?
It perhaps could be construed that way. I don't see it that way. I see it as them saying we need more instruction on recklessness and recklessness with respect to circumstances here. And when that is put up against that question number two about picking up a weapon, that's it, you're guilty. I think that they were very, very ill-informed as to intent. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.